Don't get boxed in by a whiteboarding app with limited functionality. Try Lucid, the visual collaboration platform that covers your team's entire spectrum of work. With Lucid, you can host virtual brainstorms and so much more. Diagram important processes, conduct cross-functional planning on an infinite visual canvas, power your workflows with data and intelligent automation, and bring your best ideas to life. Try Lucid for free at lucid.co/Spotify.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast and the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I will give a very broad viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by no other than the John Michael Lander. John, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm honored, and it's a privilege to be here, Zachary.
Absolutely. So you have quite the complex story. So my first question to you is, who is John Michael Lander?
Boy, that is the question, I'll tell you. I don't think I've ever had anyone ask me that question in that way. And that's incredible because it makes me think completely different. And I appreciate that. And again, I just want to go back what you said. My story to me seems so normal, so like it's no big deal because I lived it, I guess, and because of what I've went through. But I as a 14-year-old Olympic-bound athlete, the adults that were entrusted in my training, they groomed and trafficked me all 4 years of my high school career. And basically what they did is they basically became, I had taken eighth at the Junior Olympics in Lincoln, Nebraska. And there was an article that ran in the newspaper. And this lawyer, he found it and read it. And he contacted my team first and talked with them and told them that they would like to sponsor a couple of the divers. This is how they said it, that we want to sponsor some of your divers. We also want to bring in some professionals that can bring in some more money to the team. And we want to get you a new coach that can take the team to national levels. And so they were like, oh, wow, okay, great, whatever you want. And so they signed a contract. And then this lawyer approached my mother and had, you know, a couple months, they met privately, one-on-one, and he basically told her that he had a group of professional men that would be willing to sponsor me and be my sponsor. And there was a couple of things that he wanted to make sure that my mother understood, is that she had to make sure that I was at wherever they wanted me to be at the right time, at the right place, dressed the way that they ask. And so she agreed. And he also promised my mother that these professionals, whatever profession that they were in, would help our family. And so my sister just had a sledding accident, had to have a reconstructive surgery on her chin. And so what they did is they promised that they would take care of that without any expenses from my parents. My mom thought this was a great idea. She said, okay. And he says, now I have to warn you, if your son does not uphold his side of the bargain here, we will come in and you will be sued for all the back, everything that these professionals gave to you, you have to pay back. And if you can't, then we will take the children and we will put them in foster homes. And it was just kind of crazy because my parents were a foster family, and they were sponsoring and helping people come in and go. And we would have different people, different kids come in, and then my parents adopted three of them. And so it's kind of crazy to throw that back at her face, but it was one of those things, and she agreed. She thought this was a great opportunity. This could help me out, and so she signed a contract with this lawyer. Now, when those two situations are completely done, was only the time that he ever came to me to speak with me. And he had invited me to a lunch, and then he told me about how he and his professional friends could help me, that no matter how much help my parents could give, they were not going to be able to get me to the Olympics. This group of professional men were the only way that I was going to get there. It was the only way to take the burden off my parents and help my parents out. He made it such an opportunity is the word I'm looking for here. He made it an incredible opportunity, and that I was selected. I was the chosen one to get this honor. They weren't interested in anyone else on the team. He just was focusing on me. And I thought this was a great idea, but he really played on the fact that by me doing this with them, I was helping my family. And that's where I came in and thinking, well, if my mother already said it was okay and it's helping them out, then I'm into it. And so then I ended up signing a contract with them. And they did fulfill the idea with a coach. They brought in a coach. He was from Ohio State University, and he was an All-American, and he was, an up-and-comer, and everyone liked him. He had already created national champions, and this was an opportunity for him too. What I did not know was that he was part of a professional group of men. And so I was surrounded. And this is how it all started. It started out very slowly. The coach started asking my other teammates, what kind of actors do I like? What kind of music do I listen to? And then he would slowly start talking to me and giving me corrections privately and pulling me aside. And basically, he would tell me that the other divers were jealous of me because since I did so well at the Junior Olympics, I was going to be going to Norway and Denmark and traveling, and I was, positioning myself really well for the Olympic trials. And this all was just happening so fast, but so easy at the same time. And so I started to believe him. And he says, "Don't ever let anyone know how I coach because I don't want anyone to know that. This is just between you and I." My parents would often have dinner parties where the professionals would come and have dinner at our house. And so this is how it all grew up. And now these professionals, I just want to let you know that they were all like doctors and lawyers and professors, judges, police officers, therapists, and they were all part of this group. And I call it the private group. And then I also kind of nicknamed it as the CEO of trafficking, because they all protected each other. And they would do things like, if I needed a doctor or had to see a doctor, there was only one doctor I was allowed to see. That was the doctor that was a part of this group. So I lived about an hour and a half away from Columbus, Ohio. I would have to drive all the way up to Columbus, Ohio to see Dr. Strauss. And I would be left with Dr. Strauss for weekends or whatever. So that was how that all kind of meld together. Then they would have parties, and really well-known people would be there, very well-known entrepreneurs and people who were, what can I say? They were well-known. And I remember that they would line us up. There would be about five of us boys there, and they would have us in certain outfits. And I remember being the youngest, so I was always on the end. And they always put me in a white Speedo because I was the diver. And what they would do is that as we were lined up, the guests would come in and they would go down the line and they would ask questions. They would like touch our arms, they would feel us, they would look at us, they stick out your tongue. I mean, crazy things like that. And then they would go into a back room and they would place a silent bid on which boy they wanted. And this was what happened at these parties. And then the person who got the highest bid for that boy got the boy for the night or the weekend or the week, depending on how much he donated. And of course, the boy who raised the most money at the party would get special things, sort of like their tuition paid or books paid for. And in my case, all my diving equipment, all my travel expenses would be paid. And that's how they worked it. And it was all like this, not as like, I hear the word trafficking and everybody says how terrible it was. I had no idea what trafficking was. I was informed that this was what it took to become an elite athlete. So I was like, okay, this is part of it. But it just continued to grow and grow and grow. We would go to like the Super Bowl, or we would go to the Rose Bowl when Ohio State would go to any bowl game, we would go. And we were always up in the VIP sections. And when we would get there, we would, we got to meet the Ohio State football team and their cheerleaders, and we got to meet all these people. And then later on, we were privately passed off to another person who I'd spend that day with. And they would have their silent bid on which boy they wanted. And that's how they got us. And so that's basically how it worked. And that's just kind of a short rundown. So who I am is I hid this for a long time. I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what it meant. We could talk later on about how I would create ways of how I could try to gain back my control and how I would turn the tables during these events or these dates, if you want to call them that, and how I would, what I did to try to survive. And people think it's like, well, you weren't really being trafficked because you were in a posh hotel, you were taken care of, you weren't out on the streets. But we were basically doing the same things as the kids on the streets, but we were doing it in a different way. And it's just interesting how people are so quick to want to change that and make it different, put it way out there across the, not even a part of it, but this is happening in our own backyards. And if you think about it, the stat, one in four females and one in six males are sexually abused before the age of 18. If you go back to the Paris Olympics and look at how many athletes were there, or think about the FIFA World Games that are coming in, how many athletes are participating? If you take that stat and look at it, how many of those athletes are competing silently? And people constantly will often ask me why I never said anything about it. Well, I wanted to represent my country. That was my goal. And if I said anything, I was told that I would be dismissed. I wouldn't be able to compete anymore, and that nobody would ever want to work with me again. So it was constantly this whole focus on how to get what you wanted to do and get there the best you could. But there was also the fear factor. I was told that if I didn't please these professionals, that my parents would have to be sued and that all the money would have to come back. They would take the kids away. Basically, the same thing they told my mother, and that I would have to go somewhere else. And I got to see this happen. I saw this happen when one of the boys wrecked a Mercedes. And in the passenger seat, there was some marijuana. So the boy was going to go to court. And so what happened is that the lawyer who brought me in represented him. They go to a certain courthouse. It ends up that the judge is part of the group. So everything was taken care of out of court. The group of men paid money to that court, made a donation, and everything was gone. No one ever saw anything about it. But I also saw where a boy really messed up. He disappeared, and we never knew where he went, never knew whatever happened to him. So that's basically what it is. And so what I've done now with my life is I've tried to become the voice for the voiceless, is what I call it. And I try to be able to be the cheerleader for people to come forward and share their stories. I'm watching the news a lot, and if we talk about Jeffrey Epstein and they're talking about all the females that were abused, I'm here to say there were boys there as well. Because if you look at the allegedly the list of people that went to that island, there were many on that list that were not interested in girls. So were they just going to the island for a weekend for fun? So there were a lot of boys never talked about with that situation. And I just want to make sure that people know that this is happening. It's easy sometimes, and I don't want to dismiss females being taken advantage of, but a lot of times it's easier to traffic a boy because the boy is not going to talk about it. He's not going to report. He usually will keep silent because of the shame and the guilt and the societal ways that people look. Then and the fact that then I was told always that I must have wanted it, or it would never have happened. Why didn't I fight back? And we don't know about all this. I was a 14-year-old kid. when this started. And the first experience was with a 60-year-old doctor in a Motel 6. I didn't know what to do. And I was confused. I was frustrated because my body was reacting in a way that I didn't expect it to. I mean, this was, and so I got really confused. And what did this mean? And what is this now? And so it's just interesting that that happened. I was taken up to Ohio State to practice with their diving team, and I can remember listening to the older boys talk about Dr. Strauss, and it was a joke. They made it as a joke. They called him Dr. Dick, and that all the varsity team players from all like 14 different sports had to see him, and they had to get his approval so that they can compete that week. And if you didn't get the approval, you sat on the bench. So it all became like they started comparing notes. Oh, did Dr. Dick do this to you? Did Dr. Dick do that to you? Oh my God, can you believe this? And it was sad in a way because I think we all were trying to find a way to make light of it because it was such an odd, weird thing to be happening. And yet nobody was doing anything about it. I remember telling my coach about it. He said he would tell his coach, but he told me not to worry about it because it happened to everyone. It was just one of those things that you just forget about and go on. And so it was normalized so much that it was like, it took years before I realized like that wasn't right.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
So I now speak all over the world, and I write, I do articles, I do workshops, I speak at conferences, just to try to get the voice out there to realize that this trafficking of boys has been going on as long as girls, if not longer, and the numbers and stats that people have are not actually accurate, and that we need to make sure that we look at them a little bit different. But we're not going to be able to have those stats until people start coming forward and speaking. And I keep in my mind, and I say in a lot of my presentations that if we were able to go back and interview all the men who have committed suicide, we would probably find out that most of them have been sexually abused when they were children or teenagers.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's not talked about nearly enough, literally at all. And we sat down and interviewed Jess Michaels, who's a 1991 Jeffrey Epstein survivor. And in her interview, she talked about fight, flight. And obviously, there's one silent part in that because we're taught as children, you have your fight or flight, but there's also a thing called freeze. And I know you've talked about it as well. I've talked about it, and some of the other survivor friends that I have also talked about it. What is your thought process on that? And that fight or flight and then freeze. What is your thought on that?
I truly believe this. I experienced this. It is one of those things. It's kind of interesting because going through the trafficking experiences and going through the different professionals, there was always times of violence. Because anytime a so-called, I'm putting quote fingers up in the air, heterosexual men have sex with other men, egos get involved. And so all of a sudden, after it's over, they have to regain their power, so to speak. And they usually will take it out in a violent way. And so I do remember that with that first doctor at the Motel 6, when it started to happen, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't move. My body literally froze on that stupid bed. And I remember it was almost like as if I lifted out of my body, and I ended up watching from above. And it's kind of crazy to say, but I couldn't move. My muscles just, there was no way, because I couldn't comprehend at that age of 14 what was literally happening. I had never had any experiences. I never messed around with anybody else before. I hadn't even had my first kiss yet. So to experience this coming in at me this way, I couldn't move. So that was one of the things I think our brain does to protect us. So I couldn't comprehend what was going on. The next big thing was the shutdown. And so I think that's where the freeze comes in. And I think as if it's a repetitive situation, that's the first place we go to. Would I have liked to have beaten him up and run out? Yes, but I didn't know how to do that. And again, you have that whole mentality taught by my parents to respect my elders. And yet, people don't understand that. And but he touched you. Why didn't you hit him? By the time he was touching me, I was not able to move. And it is just this phenomenon that happens. Do I want to? Yes. It's like paralysis. And it's you can't even explain it. Your body goes numb. You can't even move your toes or your fingers, and you're just thinking about, I got to get my next breath in. And the next thing you know, the whole thing is over with, and you're like, what just freaking happened? So yeah, I do support the flight, fight, and freeze scenarios. And would I have liked that? Yeah, but then you've got to also remember, in my situation, it might be a little bit different than a lot of other people's stories, is I signed this contract. There was a contract that I signed that made me responsible for doing what I was put in the position to do. And I was scared of that contract, because if I didn't fulfill it, my parents and my family were going to be the people who got hurt, not me necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about whenever my first sexual assault happened, I remember just, you described it very well. It's like I felt my body literally just shut down. And it's like like you said, like looking from above. And that's what it felt like. I felt like I was floating. Like it was just this really weird experience. And this was somebody that I trusted. This is somebody that I got to know. I met him at a organization that I used to frequent a lot in my home, or like my home state and around my local area. And it was somebody that I got to know very well, or at least I thought I did. And things took a turn very fast. And my first sexual assault happened on Easter. Of all days. But and it's every time Easter comes around, I think about that. And then like years later, I run into him at a church, and it's like, you could not be any further from God than anybody else. You are not a godly person like you portray yourself to be. You are not. If I told anybody what he did, I know what the pastor would say, because I'm actually good friends with these two pastors that run this church. I just think back to that, and I looked over at my mom, and I was like, that's not who I think it is, right? And she was like, yeah, it is. And I was like, well, this is kind of coincidental, because this is part of my spiritual journey, and me and religion go way back, and I wasn't forced into it as a child. I wasn't forced into it, going into adulthood. I wasn't forced at all. But I think about that, and just like, a little bit of a side note, And anyway, so you give a lot of presentations, and one of them is about locker room talk.
Yes.
Can you walk us through like what that looks like for you, and what you experience in like hearing like the locker room? Because I have my own experiences is what I heard in the locker room. And I'll dive into that like after you share yours. And then let's see how similar they are. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes, I definitely will. A lot of times when I talk about this, I'm usually like at a university and I'm speaking to a team, and it's usually like a football or baseball or basketball team. And the locker room talk within that organization is a little bit different than, say, like a diver who is an individual sport. And, you know, you just go in and out of the locker room. But the locker room has this unspeakable code, the bro code. What happens in the locker room stays in the locker room. And a lot of times what we are hearing that is being like hazing or initiation or rite of passage are cover-up words for sexual abuse. And this is passed on from generation to generation to these locker rooms. And it's not only just the degradation of when the guys are talking, you know, about girls and putting them down or using them as ideas and, you know, the smut talk that they can do about that. It is the actual way that they feel that we're going to create a team here. We're going to do these things to the younger kids so that they can make this promise, basically, never to say anything to anybody else. Because once we become a group, we're stronger and we're going to win championships. And all these ideas, all these ideologies about how we can win the season. And it doesn't take in consideration of what it is doing to these younger kids, you know, and it's kind of a, there's no other way to say it. It's abuse. You know, flipping towels or pulling someone's pants down and shoving their head into the toilet, or even to the point of actual rape. We have seen so many schools talk about this, where the football team initiated the freshmen that came in, the seniors initiating the freshmen and sexually abusing them and then hiding it as initiation. And several schools have canceled the football season. And then the parents come involved and they're saying that this isn't fair. You know, their idea of what the team is more important than those individuals. And then the defending of the abusers, well, they didn't mean it that way. That's just what was supposed to happen. It just got a little out of hand. Boys will be boys. And that statement gives space and freedom to all these things that can happen. There was a TV show, 13 Reasons Why, and they depicted this, and a lot of people don't like that TV show, but they actually showed this young man being raped by teammates. And there's a scene where the head cheerleader comes marching into the locker room and just gives them all hell for what they did. And of course, nobody can take ownership of it. She has no right to come in here. This is a sanctuary. This is our space. And it is overlooked and no one takes any, doesn't do anything about it. And that's basically what I talk about. And it's really interesting. As I went to one school and I thought I was going to be speaking to their male teams, and it ended up being all females. And what was really interesting was to be able to pivot and hear females versions of what they think is going on in the locker room and why it's toxic. Why is there toxic masculinity happening? Why are these men not coming forward and saying something happened? Because they don't want the shame to be carried with them. And it's a constant belittling of them. By that time, before they're actually, let's make sure we get back to this whole thing. They're not abused on the first day. This hazing doesn't usually happen until later into the season, almost maybe halfway. They've already had summer practices, you know, and then they've groomed these kids just as they were groomed so that it becomes a part of the team. So I'm protecting my bros. And that's basically what I talk about. And that's what I, you know, try to hear people share back with me. And it's also the interesting is I've got another program called the Athletes Arena, where athletes actually come together and they talk about what is abuse. So if this happened to me during practice in the locker room, is that considered abuse? And they're able to discover within themselves that that was, in fact, could be abuse. And was it coming from the coach or was it coming from another player? And another thing that people do not talk about is the abuse between students. because they feel like they're the same age, they're almost the same age, so it's really not abuse. But it is. It's about power, and it's about misusing the power that they have, and they use that power to do whatever they want.
Exactly. And I remember growing up hearing boys will be boys. I heard that literally on a daily basis. And there was a lot of instances in the locker room whenever I was going through school, like middle school and high school, and they would sit here and they would make fun of me for being, calling me a fag and calling me queer and calling me this and calling me that. But they would be sitting here looking at each other's, well,
Genitals. Yeah.
they're looking at each other's genitals, and they'd be like,
They're junk.
"Oh, look how many pubes you have, or look how small your dick is, or look how big your dick is." And it's just like, and I'm sitting here being judged, but you guys, okay, or like how heavy somebody's balls are, or it's
Oh,
just like,
yeah.
or I'm gonna go to this party and I'm going to fuck this bitch and like all that type of stuff. It's just like, this is so beyond disturbing. Like
Right.
beyond disturbing. And I just think about that. And these are, your high school athletes. These are, your soccer players, your
Popular
basketball
kids.
players, like, the big, like, and here I am, like 120 pounds soaking wet. And this is before I started going to the gym and stuff. But like, I was like, I don't fit in with them. I did not find my place. It's like, I grew up that I respect each other's boundary. I
Right.
respect others' opinions and their thoughts. I mean, I may not agree with it necessarily, but that's not for me to decide. It's like, I may not agree with your political belief. I may not agree with something that you say, but I'm not going to sit here and judge it because it's you. Like, I was raised on that. And I was taught at a young age that if I see something, say something. So I did. I recorded some of those conversations and absolutely nothing happened to them. They're like, oh, they're just boys in the locker room. They're just boys being boys. No. No, absolutely not.
No.
And so you're gonna say the same thing whenever they go out and beat the shit out of their wife, or God forbid they murder somebody. That's just boys being boys? Really?
Right.
No, it's called take accountability and have accountability, because one thing is your actions have consequences, and those consequences have actions, and it goes back and forth. And people don't think about that. And I think about, growing up in rape culture, and like, you mentioned about 13 Reasons Why, and I saw a lot of myself in that series. Me and my mom like sat down and binge watched it, and she said, a lot of what you went through, you're seeing on this TV right now. Because I had friends that died by suicide. I had friends that were murdered. I had friends that, were sexually assaulted, and I became a sexual assault survivor at the age of 17, and went through 2 years of conversion therapy and went through drug addiction. And I saw a lot of myself in that series personally, and I don't speak for anybody else, I speak for myself. This was very well done, and it was very well put together. And that's my own personal thought, my own personal opinion. Sitting through reading reviews on Google, it's like, this was horrible or this was great. It's all in how you interpret it and how you see it. And obviously, these are very difficult subjects to talk about, and they're not necessarily the easiest and the most lightest subject to talk about, but it's still important to have that out there, and I'm really glad that they added, the trigger warning and content warning before the episodes, because whenever it originally came out, it did not have that.
Right.
And I was like, okay, yeah, this definitely needs some type of like trigger warning, because there are some very deep parts in it. There's some very graphic scenes. But overall, I think it depicts very well of what I witnessed as, growing up in middle school and high school myself. And I was always too feminine, or I was too skinny, or I was too this or too that. I never fit in like a box. I didn't fit in with the jocks. I didn't fit in with the theater geeks. I didn't fit in with the choir kids. I was just myself. And because I had friends in like all those groups, like we all came together, and we just joked and laughed and had a good time. But in the end, I still felt so incredibly alone that I really wish I would have had a platform like I have now. And if I would have saw that, I think it would have been totally different. And I just think back and I reflect. So think about, and I'll ask you this. Think about the first time that you shared your story publicly, like after everything, think about back to that first time. How did it feel for you to just let it out? You know, what was that experience like for you? And just walk me through that part. And I'll ask you another, like a part two question to that here in just a second.
Fantastic. Great. I just want to bounce back and tell you, interesting that you got me thinking about my experiences in the locker room. And then I'll answer your other question really quickly. I was one of those kids who came to puberty really late. I didn't have hair anywhere for a long time. And in the locker room, that was a kind of phenomenon. They were like, I was weird. I was strange. What's wrong with me? Did I shave? That was the question I would ask. But they wanted to touch. Because I guess my skin was really smooth. And then they would joke about your skin's smoother than my girlfriend's. But it was really interesting, and this is kind of a brag, and I don't mean to say it like this, but there was one area that God must have just thought, okay, we're gonna let that area grow. And they had to touch that area as well. And of course, being grabbed in the showers and stuff like that, things happen. And I was, you know, like you said, teased. Oh, you must like that. You really want that, don't you? And so those kind of things haunt me to this day. And I've never really spoke about them until just now. But coming back to the first time I ever talked about what happened to me, I did this kind of in a way that I'm not sure if I would suggest other people to do it. I did it with a TED Talk. That was my expression of coming out. But I need to preface something really quickly. Going back to when I was 16, I remember the professional man came to pick me up at the house, and we lived on a farm. And my mom was ready for him and was preparing and telling me I have to go. He's here. And I didn't want to go. And I said, Mom, I'm not going. I've had it. I had done it. This has been 2 years of this going on, and I didn't want to go anymore. And she says, that's rude. He came all this way. You have to go. And of course, at that time, I didn't know the contract she signed. And I didn't know what the fear was behind her. And so she had to get me to go. And so I was being stubborn. I wasn't going to go. And I finally then at that moment, I said, he touches me. And she looked at me really funny. And she says, what do you mean? I said, he touches me. And she goes, well, where? And I grabbed my crotch and I said, here. And her face softened for a moment, and I can remember that. And then all of a sudden, her lips got really thin and hard, and she slapped me across the face. And she said, it's not nice to make up lies about people. These are prominent people in the community, and they're helping the family. It is your job to help the family, too. Now go. If anything ever happened, you must have caused it. And at that point, I knew that if my mom didn't believe me, nobody else would believe me. So I really went inside and never shared with anybody else or never tried. Now, did I do indicators at schools? Yes, I did. Because I thought, even though I signed this contract, that I had this respect for adults, that if an adult came up and asked me what was going on, I had the right at that point to share. But the adult had to initiate the whole instigation and the questions and all that stuff. So I would do things like I was one of those kids who was impeccably dressed. And if I got dirt on my clothes, I'd have to go home and change and come back. You know, I decided that I was going to wear the baggiest clothes, the same clothes for a whole week. No one asked me anything. I thought, okay, that didn't work. I'm going to wear the same clothes and not shower the whole next week. Still, nobody said anything or asked me what was going on. And then the final thing that I did that I thought I need help, I need someone to talk to, is that I would start to drop the F-bomb. Now, I was, again, one of those kids that if I cussed, everybody laughed because I was small and I wasn't, you know, I didn't carry that kind of weight with me. And I would scream as loud as I could in the hallway or in a classroom or in the locker room. And not one professional or teacher asked me what was going on. Later on in life, I learned that they thought that I was under a lot of pressure because I was representing the United States in international competitions, and I was just going through a stressed out time. That was the excuse that they had. So when I finally decided to break my silence about what happened, it was with the TED Talk. And in front of this theater that was filled to capacity, people were still standing to share that. One was incredibly freeing, and two, was incredibly fearful. Because by putting the words out of my mouth publicly out into the universe, it meant that it was real. And I wasn't sure if I was ready for what the backlash would be. And the interesting thing about this was the backlash came from my LGBTQAI community. They all kind of ostracized me. They didn't want to have anything to do with me. And my partner at the time was part of a really important group in town, like, they called themselves the A group of gays. And he was completely removed from that group because of my TED talk. And I never have been able to understand why that ostracization happened or that separation, because I wasn't talking about the gay community. I was talking about a group of people who were doing this and who did this to me. And most of these people in this group were married men who had children my age, and who had told me that they weren't really cheating on their wives by having sex with a boy. It's not indiscretion because you can't get the boy pregnant. It's just boys being boys again. And so I never was able to wrap my head around that. So I am still at this point, and that was about what, 6 years ago that I did that I broke that story out and shared it with everybody. And it's still playing now. It's on the TED Talk website. And I still feel backlash from it. And it was interesting that the people who supported me the most were middle-aged women to older women. So it's interesting. And that's where that all stemmed from. And that also helped me write the couple books that I wrote about my experience and how it kind of affected me. But I felt a double-edged sword there. I felt this incredible relief. I remember after I was done and the audience was doing their applause or whatever they were doing, I just felt like the whole weight of this boulder on my shoulders was gone. And it was such a freeing feeling. And it was a moment of like, thank God it's over with. And it wasn't until, weeks later that I start to feel the backlash from other people about, oh, did you make this up? You must have been lying. Why would you allow this to happen? Why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you report? And it took me a while to be able to hear all that and understand that they didn't get it. And that's okay. A lot of people aren't going to get it. But why would I stand up in front of all these thousands of people and tell a story like that? So that's, I guess, a double-edged sword story for you.
Absolutely. John, thank you for sharing that part. And I think it's a critical part to talk about because even those that we trust and that we're supposed to, that are supposed to believe us, they don't necessarily always believe us, right? And just thank you for, telling your story in a candid way. So thinking back to your younger self, if you knew then what you know now, what would it look like for you and why?
Can you reiterate that a little bit?
So thinking back to like your younger self before everything transpired within your trauma and within your story, you were aspiring to be an Olympic athlete, you were going through this and you talk about this, being, Olympic bound essentially.
Right.
So thinking about that, what was like before everything happened to you? So before, just that beforehand, you like growing up, were you very like, did you always go outside and play with friends? Like, what did that look like beforehand?
Right. I yes. Thank you. That's a great question. That's why I needed to have you clarify a little bit for me. I was one of these kids who just loved life. I had boundless energy. I would bounce on the couch. I would jump over the coffee table. I'd run through the house. I'd push out through the storm doors. There's a joke that I broke more windows and glass doors by just being me. And I was about the, you would see me and I'd be like skipping down the street. I was also one of these kids who I could play Barbie dolls with the girls in the community, in the neighborhood, and then turn around and play kickball with the boys. I didn't fit anywhere. I was everywhere. And I had no problem with that. I remember one time my parents called me into the kitchen and they asked me if I wanted to be a boy or a girl. And I was like, I don't understand what you're asking me. I'm just me. I like being me. I'm everything. And I just then I would go running off after that. I would do things crazy, like I'd wear my dad's t-shirts, and he was 6'4". And so the t-shirt was kind of, would go down to my knees, and I would cinch it with a belt. But this was my superhero outfit. But in my dad's eyes, he thought it was a dress. And he had asked me, he said, "Why are you wearing a dress?" And of course, I'd come back and say, "I'm not wearing a dress. This is my Superman outfit." And he was like, "Oh, okay." So, I mean, I didn't think things like that. I didn't, what's boys or play trucks. I didn't care. I wanted to play with everything, and I wanted to be with everybody. And I was that type of person. And even when I started diving, I was so excited about it because it came naturally to me. I remember I was trying to be a gymnast first, and it was just, oh, okay, whatever. And one day I was at the local pool, and there was a lifeguard who was a college diver, and he says, "Hey, try that off the board." And I would, and he started coaching me. He says, "I want you to go call have your parents call this guy." And so we did. We met with that person that afternoon. He showed me a couple of dives, and we went to my first meet. I went to the meet. I took second, and it was like, oh, there's something here. And that's where it all started to grow. And it was like, this was a passion. It became like, I'm going to get to see the world. This is my way of being able to experience everything. And I need to go back and let people realize, because a lot of times people think that only the vulnerable children are abused or trafficked or anything like that. And I came from a really loving family. My father was an architect. It wasn't like we were wealthy, but we weren't dirt poor. My parents were very active in what we were doing and who we were. They were like the popular people in the area, in the little neighborhood that we lived in. People would always come to our house. There's home videos of Christmas parties at our house, with Santa coming through. There was the Easter Bunny during Easter. So it was like this. There was no, I want to make sure people understand there was no sense of vulnerability a part of this. So I never saw myself as being vulnerable. And I get confused when I hear people talk like that. And I had an interview last night with somebody, and I said, "Listen, it's not that the child's vulnerable. The situation is vulnerable. If the parents aren't around or something like that is happening, the situation is causing the vulnerability." And that's what's really interesting, is we need to be careful how we use certain words, because I would never identify, even today, if I went into the bathroom stalls and you see all the posters up there that say trafficking this and that, all this information. And I had an interesting discussion with a representative, and I said, "The bathroom stall posters aren't working." "Well, why not?" I said, "Well, first of all, a lot of them are directed to females. They either have a female language quality to them, or they have a sense of this is only happening to girls. As a boy, I would never identified with that, or they may have a picture of just a girl, so I won't identify with that. I don't identify with the language that you're using on that board, that or that poster." So it's interesting that we need to make sure that I love, and please don't get me wrong, I think the stall posters are important. And I'm so glad that people are doing it, but they also need to get people who are survivors involved to understand why this language isn't working. Why aren't people, being helped this way? So all that, so my whole, I'm going all over the place. I'm so sorry. But the whole point is that before the abuse happened, I was this incredible spiritual kid. It wasn't that I cared about religion as much, but as spiritually, I was connected. I thought I could fly. I knew I was able to fly if I just wanted to. And if I got enough, a good enough run, I could just lift off the ground. I had all these incredible, innocent ideas. And as being a blooming late, going into puberty, I carried that with me a lot. And so when that first time with the 60-year-old doctor happened, all that was gone. And then it became a darkness about it. It became like, wait a minute, who am I? I felt cheated. I felt like I never got to experience what it's like to have a crush on someone and explore that. Someone my age. What is that like? What is it like to try to figure out what your sexual orientation is instead of almost having it thrown down your throat, basically? And that's how I felt. I felt like, oh, now I have to be this for the rest of my life. Is it who I truly am? I don't know. I have always had a hard time trying to figure out, are you straight or you're gay? I don't know. And with this coming on to me confused me even more because I didn't understand how a father of children could be driving me to a secluded or to a hotel to have sex with me and then go home to their son. And so it's like kind of odd that, but I do know that I was being interviewed by the George Clooney production company for their documentary that they did about Ohio State. And unfortunately, I wasn't a wrestler, so I think that's says enough about that. But I remember they interviewing my mother on the phone. And my mother said she could remember that something happened because my whole demeanor changed. She didn't know what it was. And of course, she wouldn't think it was anything horrible, but she knew instinctually that something had happened. And I think mothers do know. And I think females have that sense that they can figure things out. And so that's kind of the difference that happened.
Yeah, you bring up a lot of key points. And, again, thank you for sharing that and, telling it in a way that's so easy to digest and to hear, right? And I think, oftentimes I dive deep into my own experiences, my own stories, even while sitting here on the other side of the podcast, because I'm used to being on the opposite end. So it's definitely different, asking these questions. And there's oftentimes that I sit here and I listen to somebody's story and I'm like, I feel so deeply inspired and deeply connected, and that's exactly how I feel right now. And I relate to a lot of your experiences and a lot of your story, and I think that's why you and I connected very heavily. During for those of you who don't know, I do pre-interviews with each person that I interview. We sit down, we discuss an angle, figure out things that the person is comfortable talking about. And then we sit down and we do this recording, and then it goes live across all of our social media and across all of, the streaming platforms, et cetera. But during that pre-interview is a time where, I get to know the person that I'm talking to. And John, whenever we sat down and did your pre-interview, it went past the time what I always set an hour aside, but I was like, you know what? I just can't stop listening to the story and listen to this, listening to you speak. And I wanted to say thank you for coming on the podcast, and I want to say thank you for, sharing your experiences and your story. I think it's really going to resonate with a lot of people who are listening because it touched me. It inspires me to keep going because we need to shatter these narratives that it's not boys being boys. It's not. It goes beyond that. And I remember hearing that as a child, and I just thought that that was okay, and I thought that that was normal. Okay, this is what I'm supposed to be experiencing, this is what I'm supposed to be seeing. And then I get older, I reflect, and I'm like, no, it's really not. And I think about that. But, again, thank you for coming on the podcast today. Is there anything else that you would like to share with anybody who may be feeling alone in this fight against these oppressive systems, against what's happening in the world right now? There's a lot going on. The headlines are very heavy. Is there any type of or anything that you would like to share with anybody out there who may be listening?
Yes, I would love to. First of all, I want to thank you because you created such a, and it sounds like a coined phrase, but a safe space to be able to share and to be able to discover even new things. And that's what happened in the pre-interview with you as well. I discovered things that I have not thought about for a long time. And so you have a gift, and that's something I just want to thank you. And I take it into my heart saying thank you so much because you allow me to expose my truth. And I think that's important. I want to just two really quick things is that, it's not always males who are the predators. There are a lot of females out there too. We had a situation here at a local school where a substitute teacher had sex with three sophomore boys. And the boys got together and started to compare notes. And then some girls overheard them talking and they went to the principal and she was brought up on charges. But while they were going into this process of her testimonies and stuff like that, the parents of the boys wrote letters in defense of her because she made their boys men. That is the society we are in. Not the fact that she took advantage and used her power to take advantage of these three boys who were what, 15? And but we should celebrate that. Why are we celebrating certain things? And I guess I could bring up questions about who's in power of us today, and how does that, what is that saying to our young men and people? But I really want to say to those of you who may think that you had experienced something unnormal or strange, whatever words you want to use, but there's a feeling inside of you. I'm going to tell you that the chances are you probably did. And you should try to seek help. And people need to find the best way of getting help that works for them. I had a hard time with therapists because some of the professionals that I dealt with were therapists. So I would, I have a hard time going into a therapist's office because that's where a lot of abuse would have happened. And so it wasn't until I met a woman who was part of the Self-Talk Institute, who basically she said this thing to me, and I hold it dear to my heart, so much so that I've become a certified coach myself. She said, "John Michael, the event happened. We cannot change the event or who was there or any of that. That's happened. It's done with. But what we can do is change your mindset and the meaning that you keep putting on that event. Because if you keep putting negative ideas onto that event, you will remain in victimhood all your life. But if you can change the way you look at it, you can free yourself and you can move forward and help other people." And that is what I want to say to everybody. This is not a death threat. It's not like an ending. You can take this and change it. And the thing is, that's really interesting is that people have asked me recently, "Are you still angry about what happened?" There is always going to be a sense of anger, I think, about what happened because I was out of control. I was not in any control there. But what I realized lately is that if those events didn't happen, I wouldn't be here speaking with you today. Our paths would never have crossed. And that's something that I find kind of remarkable in a way, is that everything that has happened has helped create who I am today and what I do today and the empathy I have for other people. And I just, I'm not want to say, I don't want to say I'm grateful for it, but I'm also trying to look at it differently and say, oh, okay, that happened. And now this is who I am. I could play the game of who could I have been? What would I have been like if that never happened? I could have gone to the Olympics. I could have been an Olympic champion. I could have been all these things, but maybe that's not what this was supposed to be about. And so now I'm able to talk to you. I'm able to talk to survivors who are trying to figure their own lives out and help them and be a part of their life and their journey as well.
It's all about building the community and finding people that you can turn to whenever things get very dark and very rough. And it's all about finding those spaces and finding that community because it's incredibly important right now. Because again, those headlines are very dark, they're very deep, they're very, I mean, every time I turn on the news, it's just something else and something else, something else. It's just an ongoing pattern. We hear about mass shootings, we hear about just devastating things coming down, from the federal government, from Congress. It's just a lot. But hearing
You're absolutely,
stories, go ahead.
no, you're absolutely right. And there's a beautiful thing that I heard the other day by Lily Sanders. I was doing an interview with her on the podcast, and she said, we've all gone through some type of trauma, and it's our testimonies that build bridges to help others to survive. And I thought that was really kind of interesting and beautiful in a way that we're building bridges to help others so that we all could come together to get through this as one. And again, you bring up the shootings and stuff like that. And it's so sad to me is that we don't ever talk about the people who survived those shootings. What's happening to them? I listened to Elizabeth Smart. I don't know if you remember her. She was kidnapped from her home and spent 9 months with her captors. And to listen to her talk is almost to hear the hope that things can work out and how we need to look at things differently in order to help each other. Because if we keep acting and reacting, we're going to constantly keep the anger growing. And we've got to find a way to grab hold of each other's hands, let each other know that we're not alone, we're in this together, and to help each other.
And that is exactly what testimony from you is doing for so many. And again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. Again, everybody, John Michael Lander, feel free to follow him on social media. John, what's your social media handles?
Okay, can we post them? I don't remember them right now.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I'm so
So
sorry.
anybody who
My
wants to follow John, just look in the description and we will
I
post the social media
apologize.
handles.
I feel like I've opened up so many new things with you that I've like, what my digits? My oh, I don't re I, but this was so amazing, and I thank you for the kind words and everything. And you're amazing, dude. You really are. I
Likewise,
called
my
you
friend.
dude. Oh my God, I called you dude. I'm sorry.
No, you're completely fine. I absolutely love it. And, again, thank you just for everything that you do and everything that you are. I think it's going to really resonate with a lot of people, who is hearing this. And to everybody who is hearing, these are the conversations that we need to be having. These are the conversations that are going to shatter those glass ceilings and break down those walls of injustice within our communities. And John, again, thank you so much. I really appreciate you, John Lee.
Thank you.